Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Welcome to Conversations. Sid Kirkby is, without any exaggeration, one of the most remarkable people I've ever met on this program. Sid has done something which no human being will ever do again, at least not on this planet. Sid first went to Antarctica in 1956 to survey the last unknown continent on Earth. Sid's managed to survey more coastline than Captain James Cook ever did. And he went to Antarctica at a time of dog sleds and heavy woolen clothing, before satellite communication, before GPS. And he returned there again and again over the next three decades. Realistically, Sid was a man who should never have been an explorer in the first place, because he contracted polio as a little boy. But he became one of our great explorer scientists anyway. Sid, welcome. Now, before we start talking about your own remarkable life, we have to talk first about your dad, don't we?
Yes, my dad was absolutely fundamental to everything I am, to my recovery from polio, to moulding me, my attitudes and my will and whatnot. He's a great man.
Tell me about his character, the kind of man he was.
Well, he was an intensely emotional man, quick-tempered, not bad-tempered. I hasten to say quick-tempered rather than bad-tempered. He was powerfully intelligent, great intellect, self-educated man.
Yes, he had to do that all himself, didn't he?
He did, yes, yes. He came from a family. My paternal grandfather was a most wonderful grandpa, but an absolute disaster as a father and husband. He was a drunk. So Dad's childhood was pretty tough, and he left school at 13 and had to go on and educate himself. But he was a man of great compassion. His credo basically was that you can do anything you are prepared to pay the price of. He also carried a saying that they can't do this to you, son. You can resist anything.
Well, how useful was this to you? Because at the age of five, Sid, you contracted polio. Do you remember much from that time? Do you have any pictures in your head of that?
Yeah, it's difficult to know how much you actually remember and how much has been told to you later on. I suppose some things I am sure I remember. I remember being sick. I remember, post the sickness, an enormous level of tension, because my father committed himself to Sister Kenny's approach to my rehabilitation. You may recall that Sister Kenny is that wonderful Queensland nurse who flew in the face of all medical opinion and understanding at the time that polio was a disease of the muscles and was treated by keeping people warm and bedridden and rest and whatnot. Sister Kenny says, work 'em. Get them up and make them work.
And she was right, wasn't
she? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. She was right. But there was tremendous tension. And Sister Kenny, of course, it must have been horrifying for her to have the contumely that she encountered from the medical profession. But even in my father's case, he came in for a lot of flack. My maternal grandparents were particularly scathing, on the grounds that he sets himself up to know more than the doctors. Well, I've got news for you. He did.
Oh, the proof's in the pudding, isn't it, Sid? I can't think that. So there was a lot of tension in the family because, I don't know, everyone else thought your dad had subscribed to the theories of a quack.
Absolutely.
And it was cruel.
Yeah, and cruel, yes.
Because it was, of course, dragging you out of bed.
Yeah, dragging me out of bed, making me work. Pretty tough love, a lot of this stuff. And even within the immediate family, my mother, like any mother, I suppose, she just wants to nurture and cuddle and make things nice and comfortable and easy for her wee bairn.
So what was your dad's therapy?
Well, he quit his job.
He
quit his job and he got a contract delivering mail, which he did at night, so that he had all day to devote to my rehabilitation. He had an old Harley Davidson motorbike. He would sit me on the petrol tank of that with his arms wrapped around me on the handlebar so I couldn't fall off. And he would take me down to the South Fremantle Swimming Baths, which is a fenced-off bit of beach down at South Fremantle. And he would there carry me down onto the beach, and I had calipers, and I could sort of stand, but couldn't move at all. And he'd unstrap the calipers from my legs, and he'd rush into the water and cavort and splash around and say, gee, it's beauty in here, son, la-di-da-di-da. And I would lie on the sand, and I hated being a cripple. I really hated it.
So what did you do? Did you try and crawl in?
Or? I'd crawl into the water. And once in the water, and I was lighter, I could do more. My upper body's always been fine. And I could thrash around, swim and whatnot. And gradually I built up more muscle tone. But the level of engagement of my father in this is difficult to comprehend. He would swim with me, and we would swim and swim and swim and swim. And it was always seemed to be, or not always seemed to be, always was, that when I was absolutely exhausted and couldn't swim another stroke, we would be at the deep end of the pool. So I would either have to swim another length of the pool back onto the beach and crawl up the beach, or I would have to somehow clamber up the ladder to the wooden walkway. So there was always that extra bit. And it must have been hard on him. Must have been hard on him. Then as I got a little bit better and I was able to walk around without the calipers, we'd be walking in from the deep end of the pool, and I would know inevitably that it would happen, but I could never resist it. I could never stop it. I would find myself between him and the edge of the pool. And as we walked along, he'd have an arm around my shoulder, and he would stumble and fall against me and knock me into the pool.
You'd have to swim some more.
I'd have to swim some more. Wonderful man.
But it worked.
It worked.
You're walking. You started walking again. I just wonder how powerful that must have been for you, Sid, as a boy to have beaten this. And I'm assuming you were still a boy. How many years was this?
Well, I guess I was what you'd call rehabilitated by the time I was 12, 7 years. Within a couple of years, I had the ability to walk and whatnot, but I was clumsy, weak. For me, I was a kid, and kids are pretty opportunistic things. I, to my dreadful shame, I admit that I milked this. I was quite prepared in those early years to let mother give me special treats and whatnot. Didn't work with my father.
A chocolate for the poor little boy with polio.
Absolutely.
Your dad's, meanwhile, your dad's knocking you, bumping you into the pool to get you to swim more.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I suppose that can't help but fix an idea in your head that things can be overcome.
Oh, absolutely.
There's nothing
you can't do. Yeah. And indeed, that everyone in the family knew because Dad told us that you can do anything you are prepared to pay the price for.
Prepared to pay the price for.
Yep.
Great Antarctic explorer. Sid Kirkby is with me at the moment. Sid, when did you first entertain thoughts of being an explorer? Was it as a boy?
Yes, as a very young boy, even before polio. We had a near neighbour, Mr. Goiter, Frank Goiter, known as Uncle Frank. He was a million years old. I guess he must have been 80-odd at that time. And when I was four, I had some sort of set-to with my mother, I would think, and I ran away from home. We lived in Preston Point Road in Fremantle and overlooking on a sandstone cliff, overlooking the harbour, little boat builders and whatnot down the bottom. And it was a great place for a kid to run away. So I took my lovely timber model yacht and I went down to the river and I sailed it because I was divorcing my parents.
Yes, right. I was sacked.
Yes, I was sacked. And in the course of that, my boat got away from me and sailed right across the other side of the river. Well, it was a very precious possession, and it took me a good long while to find one of the boat builders who was prepared to row me across the river and recover the boat and bring it back. By which time, my absence had been noted at home, and they mounted search parties to find me. Lateish in the afternoon, I had had enough of being run away, and it was getting time to eat, so I came back to home, and everybody else was out searching, but Uncle Frank had been commissioned to hold the fort and in case I did come back. But everyone's scouring the bush and the cliffs and the river and whatnot.
Fearing the worst.
Fearing the worst. My word, so much fearing the worst that we had a well in the backyard with a limestone coping around it, and it had a timber cover over the top, and they'd even taken the top off the well to see if my body was in there. Now, how the hell they ever thought they'd drag the cover back over on top of me after I'd fallen in the well, I don't know. But anyway, Uncle Frank was sitting there, and I sat with him on the coping of that well at 4 years of age, and he talked to me about explorations in South Australia. And I thought at 4 years that being an explorer was the best thing you could be.
He was a great explorer himself, Frank Goyder. I used to live near a Goyder Street in Adelaide,
right,
named after him.
Yes.
He's got his name all over the place.
Yes, the whole family were very prominent in South Australian exploration.
So you had this little glimmer in your mind of what it would be like to do that, and you recover from polio, more or less.
Yes.
And you start going to school. You took up boxing for a while.
So. Yes, I did. Because I couldn't, and in fact, even when I was at my very best, I was not what you would call agile. I could never run or jump, and I didn't have a lot of ball skills. I intensely wanted a sport that I could compete at on equal footing. Not necessarily to win all the time, but a few wins are nice, but certainly do it competitively. And my father suggested two things to me, ballet dancing and boxing. Those are things you can do, son.
Back in those days, if you wanted to do ballet dancing, you would have had to do the boxing as well, wouldn't you, in order to defend
absolutely
yourself from yes, from abuse. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So you did the boxing.
So I took up boxing on the grounds that it is probably the least physical and most sport most based on will and intellect, more than any other sport, I think. It's also, and it appeals to me in this respect, in that it's very simple. Keep it simple. Let's not complicate the issue with rules and things
so,
like that.
So were you any good as a boxer?
I was pretty handy fighter, yeah.
So why did you give it up?
Well, my working life started to interfere with it, but I really stopped when, for the first time, I heard seriously a boxing crowd who, by and large, are not attractive. I was fighting a chap who was a very good friend, and I had hit him, and you know when an opponent is in trouble, the whole body gets a set to it and their face gets a look. And this chap was a temperamental fighter, so when he's hurt, his whole instinct is to come at you as hard as he can go. It's intuitive and semi-conscious even. And so I was backing away from expecting the referee to stop the fight. In the backing away, I was not doing very much, and I actually listened to the boxing crowd.
And what were they saying?
Kill him. Tear his head off. Things of that nature. And it actually horrified me because between fighters, of course, there is none of that. Fighters don't operate in that level. When fighters fall on each other's necks at the end of a particularly bruising and hard fight, it is because they love each other. And they love each other because they have taken each other to this wonderful place.
But the crowd is
crowd is not
else.
Nice. Yeah, I would love to see boxing as a sport which had no spectators. No, I know that's impossible. But I don't think it's appropriate that there should be spectators.
It tells you something ugly about human beings, doesn't it?
A crowd of people who fancy themselves
as civilized people will shout things like, kill him.
Yeah.
So you gave it away, and you were going to be a lawyer. You were going to study law, Sid.
Yes.
And that all changed. Why?
Well, I have no idea why I was going to be a lawyer, but for as long as I could remember, it was the accepted thing that I was going to read law. Halfway through the first term of my last year at school, where I'd been doing all arts-oriented courses since in senior school, I suddenly thought, what am I doing?
I hate this.
I said, no.
Normally takes lawyers a couple of years to realise that, so you're ahead of the pack.
Yes, well, yeah, gee, and in my working life, I've struck whole heaps of young people who have gone through and they've acquired their tertiary education and they've entered into a career which they had no idea whatsoever what it was going to be, and they hate it.
The world of comedy is full of ex-lawyers.
Yes. I noticed that. I wonder what it is about it.
So what did you do? You got this sort of blinding
flash.
Well,
I got this blinding flash and I converted over from humanities to an arts to a science course, and I suddenly started doing the maths and the physics and the chemistry that I hadn't done in senior school, and I found it a bit of a struggle. Now, I'm not the world's most energetic person by any stretch of imagination. I don't like
to
work.
You've been to Antarctica. What are you saying? If you're not energetic, what hope is there for the rest of us, Sid?
No, I don't like to work any harder than is necessary. And so my matric was spectacularly mediocre, I'd say. But I did do well enough to get accepted into surveying, which immediately folded then in Western Australia because there were only three people in the state who were stupid enough to be wanting to do it. But in those days, there was a system very similar to the way engineering operated, with a reciprocating board where you could do articles to a mentor and a practitioner. And I was very, very fortunate in getting articled to Mr. Vernon Fife, the then Surveyor General of Western Australia. Wonderful, wonderful man.
So this was a kind of apprenticeship then, in other words.
Yeah, you paid him £400 and you signed a great deed from florid writing. He undertook to mentor you and see you developed and persuade or force you to study diligently. Which is biting off a fair bit for some of the masters to do that, I think. Mr. Fife amongst them.
And there you were. Sid, one of the things I love about your story is very shortly afterwards, you become part of the Great Sandy Desert Expedition, into the Great Sandy Desert in West Australia.
Yes. Wow. Yes, well, that was wonderful. That was a big turning point. I suppose by the time I was, you know, 2 or 3 years into my cadetship, the prospect of actually being an explorer wasn't great because there didn't seem to be a whole lot of it on the market these days. And then suddenly out of the blue, the Commonwealth Government and the Western Australian State Government put together an expedition to work through the Great Sandy Desert.
Why? What was there to do?
Well, there were already the inklings that basin was perhaps an oil and gas source, and it was an unmapped region apart from anything else in Australia, barely penetrated by the fewest handful of explorers.
I was just wondering what you'd see. You said, well, there's a bit of sand, there's another bit of sand.
No, actually, the Great Sandy Desert. The Simpson is a pretty dull desert for my money, but the Great Sandy is a beautiful, beautiful desert. Endless kilometres of great, vivid red sand ridges with their sand as fine as hourglass sand, and the spin effects, and of course at that time the Aboriginal people who were, although they knew of white people, they'd had no contact.
You encountered them out there?
Yes. I did three trips through the Great Sandy over the next few years, and spent a little time with the Aboriginal people while they were still tribal.
Were you fascinated by them to this day? You wonder how they managed to survive out there.
Well, they did it very hard, but proudly. And this, I guess, is the terrible tragedy that struck me between 54 and about 59 or 60, 62. The change that had occurred with the Aboriginal people. And in 54, they, so far as they knew, they were doing it absolutely right. And whilst they might forage all day long, and the whole family might have three or four spinifex lizards and a handful of spinifex seeds and a couple of desert walnuts, hardly anything to live on, they had a pride in their achievement. And these little tiny people who lived so hard, and they were little tiny because the country just wouldn't support anything but little tiny people. And they would come up to you and stand up to about my mid-chest and put a sole of a foot on a knee and earnestly tell you all about it in a language which you had no comprehension whatsoever. And you would answer them earnestly in a language of which they had no comprehension whatsoever. And it was pretty nice.
Was any communication possible?
Yeah. Actually, you it's remarkable, and it's not just with the Aboriginal people. We found it with dealing with the Russians and the Japanese and whatnot in Antarctica. Even the Americans, for God's sake. You can actually make yourself understood with a bit of luck.
Over time, it can happen. The great Antarctic explorer, Sid Kirkby, is my guest this morning, a man whose father told him, you can do anything if you are prepared to pay the price. So in there in the great sandy desert, tell me about those feelings you get there when this is the first, I'm imagining this is the first great, I don't want to use the word wasteland, but the first great empty space you go into. Did you see it as empty? What feelings?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
What feelings did that bring out in you?
Well, a powerful feeling of being involved with expansive nature. At that time, I had fairly deep religious feelings, which over the years evaporated into atheism. But at that time, I saw God's hand in the scope and the magnitude and the wonders. There's also a continuing feeling in deserts. Because deserts are so simple and so pure and so straight, the issues they propose to you are fundamental. And you can address fundamental issues of where do I get water? How do I get over this sand dune? And these are very, very simple, uncomplex thoughts. But they need to be handled by you. So you feel a high level of satisfaction at your ability to cope with them. The ability to find a drink in the desert is a great joy.
And the silence?
Yeah. I just actually was reading recently a talk I did some years ago on that great sandy desert trip, and I mentioned the fact that deserts, including the cold desert of Antarctica, they're silent. Even then, whether they're filled with the roar of wind or fire or the crash of thunder, no matter what noise is about, there still is this element of quietness and stillness. And if you like it, to sort of anthropomorphize it, it's almost as though they have the presence and self-possession of a very, very knowingly competent person.
Oh, that's
I know that
thought.
Sounds high-flown.
No, that's a fascinating thought. I'd like to stop the show and think about that for a while. Does the silence have its own quality? There's a book that came out recently on silences and says you only have to think about the kind of silence you hear in a vacant room compared to the silence of a desert, compared to the silence of a night somewhere, to realise that silences have their own quality to them.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. The silence of disapproval, for example, is horrid. The silence of the desert is wonderful.
It was around about that time you were in the desert. You got a telegram about your dad.
Yes, yes. I got a telegram over the old Flying Doctor Network saying my father had been diagnosed with cancer and he was expected to live about 4 months, and suggesting that I hurry back, that I pull out and come home.
Were you with him when he died?
I was eventually, but a day or two later, I got a telegram through the same network from my father saying, "You know, people don't tell me when to die, son. You stick about as long as you need. I'll hang on." So I came back and he hung on. And then when the prospect of going to Antarctica in 1955 came up, he was quite advancedly sick. He was 12 months overdue to be dead by that time. And naturally, although I desperately wanted to go to Antarctica, I also would not have gone if it had meant not being with my father when he died. And so I said to him, "Dad, can you pay the price and hang on?" And he said, "Of course I can hang on, son. No doubt, no. You go. I'll guarantee to be here when you come back in 19 months' time."
You are listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today you're hearing the story of Sid Kirkby. Sid first went to Antarctica in the 1950s when it was a whole different world. He's mapped more coastline, it said, than Captain James Cook, and has been to places where no living creature has ever been before. You were telling us the story about your dad who had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. He'd hung on all that time and agreed to hang on while you were away.
Yes. He said in about July of 55 that he would hang on. I left Western Australia in August 1955, went off and had my fun in Antarctica and came back in early April 1957. And my father had said he would hang on, so he hung on. And he was still alive when I arrived back. He was not able to come out to the airport to meet me when I came back, and that bitterly disappointed him. He was in bed. I rushed home and I saw him. He lived another 12 months after that. Truly awesome willpower involved in that. For example, he was on unlimited self-injected morphine because he was a dead man. And if he got sore, he'd have a needle and go off into a half world. And sometimes he would go to sleep and sleep for an hour or two or three. Sometimes he'd just sort of drift away for 2, 3, 5 minutes and come back. So I spent a lot of time talking with him. And on one occasion, he'd had a needle, gone off into his half world. And I would sit and see whether he was going to be away for a long time or come back shortly. And this occasion, he, after about literally 2 or 3 minutes, he suddenly sat up and shook his head violently and said, "What sort of man am I? Here's my son talking to me, and I go off into a drug-induced half-world. I shall never touch another narcotic again in my life." And he did not. And I never saw any indication that it cost him anything other than the decision to do it.
The willpower.
Yeah.
And you were with him at his side when
he died? When he died, yes. Like most of us, he had his little conceits, and one of his conceits was that he was very good at doing cryptic crossword puzzles. So we used to subscribe to the Times, the London Times, for the sake of its cryptic crossword puzzles, and we would sit and do these together. And he was in hospital in his last month or two or three, and we were doing the Times crossword puzzle one Saturday afternoon, and there was a clue we couldn't get. It was a literary illusion. And it just wouldn't work. It happened. When all the rest of the puzzle was done, it was quite obvious what it was meant to be. However, the illusion was wrong. It was fun. Dad got cranky and said, "This is dreadful. Semi-literacy out of the Times. Fetch me pen and paper. We'll write to them." And so we sat and composed a letter to the London Times about their cryptic crossword puzzle. And he signed it with a flourish, S.F. Kirkby. And died.
In that moment.
Yeah.
tell me then about going to Antarctica, because you actually had to do a bit of fakery in order to get on board.
Yeah, I did.
You had to disguise your health, your condition.
Yeah, I'd gone through life being rejected for just about everything that required any level of physical prowess on the basis of having had polio. For God's sake, National Service knocked me back, wouldn't even take me. Come on. I'm not that bad. So I felt intensely the injustice of being judged of what people assumed I was rather than what I believed I was and I think was able to demonstrate that I was. So I not only had that, but when I first heard about the Phil Law being interviewed about the upcoming expedition, I thought, this is just a thing for me. I'll take this on.
You've done hot. Time to do cold.
Yes. So I made the inquiries about it, and I learned that they had a minimum age of 28 and that they wanted a graduate surveyor. This is a bit of a fly in the ointment because I was 21 and I hadn't yet sat my final exams. And so when I sent my letter of application off, I may have been less than completely frank about my position, and I may have made more of the fact that I was a veteran of the Great Sandy Desert than the fact that I was a student and 21. Anyway, long and short of it was that I must have told the story persuasively enough, because Phil Law turned up in the old Commonwealth Centre in Forest Place in Western Australia to interview me, and I walked in. He looked me up and down and he said, "You're a remarkably young-looking 28. And I wondered briefly whether to lie in my teeth or whether to try and turn it some other way. So I said, "No, what you're actually looking at here is the most remarkably mature 21-year-old. He said, "What I'm looking at is the most cheeky young bugger. You'd better sit down and we'll have a talk." Well, by this stage of the game, I'd done a bit of research on Phil, and I knew that he was an intervarsity lightweight boxing champion. And I desperately steered the conversation to fighting. Now, everyone knows that every fighter has taken one hit too many and their brains are scrambled. And as evidence of that, I managed to engage Phil in talk about fighting and ancillary things. And he asked me, as I recall it, hardly anything at all about my working life, although I now know that he actually had checked that all
out. Right, he checked you out, right?
Before that. And so I left there thinking, boy, poor old Philly, you know, he's over 40 and he's obviously his brain's atrophy. And boy, did I pull the wool over his eyes. Well, the long and short of it was that I got the Guernsey and I got selected into that expedition.
So tell me then about that voyage crossing the Southern Ocean.
Wonderful.
In the
little tiny chartered Danish ice-strengthened cargo ship, Kistedan. Beautiful little ship, 14 expeditioners in the extreme forecastle of the deck, two about 10-foot square cabins, a converted paint locker. You looked around for small expeditioners to put in the paint locker because it was in the extreme flare of the bow. And even so, the fellow on the bottom bunk had his legs going up the side of the ship as he lay on his bunk. There was one toilet and one shower up there, and the water used to freeze in the pipes that carried up for flushing the toilet. So it was not the most congenial accommodation. And, of course, with the being in the extreme bow of the ship, it up and down. It was not luxury.
No. And the coal, I'm thinking this is a time before really synthetic fibres were around. And
yes.
So what are you wearing, wool?
Wool. But don't knock it. To this day, I believe that the natural fibres are quite as good from a warmth and moisture repellent point of view as the synthetic fibres. But what they are is very difficult to keep in good condition. See, looking at a thing like, say, a caribou sleeping bag, which is every bit as warm as a downfilled sleeping bag, two things. It weighs twice as much. But even more critically, when you're in your sleeping bag, you're sweating out of your, or transpiring out of your wet clothing from sweating, all your body sweat and your own breathing and transpirational moisture, and it freezes in your sleeping bag. A caribou bag might well pick up 10, 15, 20 pounds of ice. A down sleeping bag, I've never known a down sleeping bag get more than 5 or 7 pounds of ice in it. The significance of that is that when you stop at night, your bag is frozen. You've got to smash it all flat and you've got to get in. And before it is effective, you've got to thaw this ice with your body heat. And so it's really very, very nice to thaw 5 or 7 pounds of ice rather than 10 or 15 pounds
I bet it is, Sid. So you recall arriving at the coast of Antarctica, and what didn't we know about Antarctica?
Well,
just about everything, really.
Just about everything, yeah. Up until towards the end of the 1960s, with the exception of the immediate precincts of the stations, I had never landed on a place on the Antarctic coastline where anyone else had ever set foot. And that's on about a third of the compass of the globe.
Did we know its coastline had not been fully mapped?
No, it certainly hadn't. It
was like terra
incognita. Some of it had been photographed by the American High Jump Firm, by us on our successive summer voyages. We gradually built up a picture of it. We plotted coastline as we sailed along it.
So it was like those old explorer's maps, in other words, of Australia, where you see fragments of coastline.
Absolutely, yes.
And terra incognita.
Yeah. I have sitting in my car right at the moment, because I was talking to it elsewhere, the first map ever drawn of the Prince Charles Mountain. Now, this is a vast mountain system. Embraced in it is the biggest glacier in the world, the Lambert Glacier, which we discovered and named in 1956. It's a river of ice between 40 and 100 kilometres wide, 2.5 kilometres deep, drains an area the size of Western Australia. Now, by anyone's counting, that's a serious river.
I reckon.
And these vast mountain systems of peaks going thousands of metres up out of the ice. We were the first ever to see it, penetrate it, sledge through it, and we sledged up and down through it for months on it. And I have the map, the first map that ever depicted that country.
Being there in that ice where this is, I don't know what human habitation was there when you went there. Were there bases set up then? Was there?
Yeah, Mawson Station was there. The British had a station over in the Weddell Sea. The Americans were building a station and the Russians were building a station.
So going out there, it's empty in a way, and in a different kind of way, I suppose, to the Great Sandy Desert, or is it comparable? What are your...
Well, Antarctica, once you get up on the high plateau, and the thing to bear in mind with the high plateau is that only to this very day, very few people have actually been up on the high plateau. Even fewer people have travelled on the ground in the high plateau. You get up there perhaps 2,000 or more, 3,000 metres above sea level, very cold. In the Australian sector where it's very windy, the ground, the wind-packed snow, as hard as the ground under your feet, furrowed in great wind-carved furrows called sastrugi, might be up to 1.5 metres, nearly 2 metres high in places. Great, like ridges through it. And over it all, the wind blows and the wind carries with it fine drifting snow. Might be one day about knee-high, might be 20 feet over your head next day. It's just depending on the strength of the wind and what's happened with snowfalls elsewhere. And this is carried along. I have a photograph, I think it may have been one of the ones you looked at this morning, of a tent with the drifting snow around it. That, to me, is absolutely redolent of the solitude of the plateau. And in those times, of course, you didn't know what was over the horizon. So you were sort of toppling off the edge of the known world with every footstep. And it's glorious stuff. It really is lovely, lovely feeling stuff. But in this intense solitude, there is absolutely no loneliness because you have one or two or three comrades. And I use the word comrade because it is the only word that fits the relationship between sledging Antarcticans.
Sledging Antarcticans. I don't imagine there are too many of those.
We all, I think, believe see each other as comrades.
But you did go sledging. You had dog sleds.
Yes, in those days. Yes.
How do they work? Do you ride on the dog sled?
No, you don't.
You're not being carried along like a chariot?
No, you are. Everyone knows about dog sledging because they've been into the movies and they've seen the image of the little timber hut in Canada, the smoke rising up.
Someone saying mush.
And the fella disgustingly handsome in a king's ransom of furs, and these quiet dogs that aren't peeing on you or fighting each other. Not one single bit of that is true.
Not as romantic as all that?
No, not at all. No, it was in fact a terrible business, dog sledging. Brutal, ruthless, cruel, desperately physically hard. You run beside the sledge and around the sledge and chasing untangling dogs and whatnot.
You run beside the sledge.
We used to aim at trying to do 20 nautical miles, about around 38 kilometres a day of running.
How do you run in snow for protracted periods of time? That's like, I have trouble at the beach running through deep sand.
It's not easy. One of the beauties of Australian Antarctica, this very windy area, and whilst you curse the wind like all get out, and it is very, very hard, the wind tears you about much more than cold does, the ground is fairly hard. It's rough from wind furrowing, but it's fairly hard. But we would regularly run 40 kilometres a day. In fact, on one occasion, a mate and I ran 67 nautical miles, about 130 kilometres in 16 hours, in 15 kilograms of clothing, after having pulled down the tent and packed the sledge and before pulling up the tent again at the end of the day. That's a goodish day's work.
You sent me some pictures of your time there. With your permission, we'll put some of those up on the website because they're mind-blowing, Sid. They're mind-blowing, those pictures. Some of the loveliest pictures there are of the Aurora Australis, the Southern Lights. You know, the North has the Aurora Borealis. We have the Southern, the Aurora Australis.
Yes.
Electron streams going across the bottom of the world. Yeah. Give me a sense of what that's like to be there at night and watch these wonders unfold in the sky.
Absolutely brilliant. And, of course, the auroras are going on all the time. It doesn't have to be night. It's just only you see them at night. But to be out sledging in autumn or spring when you're getting darkness, you really don't want to be too far away from home. On the sea ice, you're okay in the depths of winter, but you don't want to be up on the plateau in the depths of winter. It's pretty ordinary. But to be in spring amongst the mountains and have the sunset and the aurora display, and we would often just go and lie on our backs outside the tent if it was weather was halfway decent, just in awe and wonder at the aurora because they're so grand. You know, people think of it as just being sort of either a pink or a greeny glow. It's not at all. It's vividly mobile and coloured, every colour you can think of from the sun. You recall that vivid red aurora.
And it moves too. It's like a shifting curtain, isn't it?
Yeah. Some of it's like gauzy coloured curtains being blown all around the sky. Some of it is sometimes you get like coloured rain falling upon a transparent dome over you and spreading down the side. It is every shape and form and movement that you can think of. And this is the thing with Antarctica, that it is everything. It is from the unspeakable beauty of a tiny little ice crystal, which when you look at it carefully, it has this wondrous form and shape, through the exquisite colours, delicate colours, through to the magnificent, big, serious power. Think of a wind that breaks the tie down of a 16-ton, fully laden DC-3 aeroplane. About 50, 60 tons braking strain capacity, snapped like that, boom. And a 16-ton aeroplane picked up and blown about 15, 16 kilometres. That's power. That's power in anybody's language.
The smallest to the most mighty thing, in other words. Yeah. The tiniest to the most mighty thing. Yep. So, to the most microscopic, to the planetary, in its force and scale.
Yep.
within that and being safe, having those moments of safety, I suppose, or even danger, do you have moments of almost perfect happiness?
Oh, pretty much all the time. Pretty much all the time. You know, happiness is not necessarily dependent upon being comfortable or not being aware of any threat to you or of having a full belly. None of those things are fundamental to happiness. If they're serious enough, of course they can be a distraction. But I have intense recollections of being actively, positively happy in difficult situations.
What about the protracted winter where you don't see daylight? And you've been on many expeditions over several decades. Yeah. We've been talking about your first visit, but you went back again and again right up to the 1980s,
yeah.
Sid. And Sid Kirkby is my guest this morning, one of the great Antarctic explorers. What about during that night, that winter long night?
Well,
don't you go mad?
No, I don't. No.
You seem all right now.
Maybe I did. Well, I think we all have some level of apprehension about what it's going to be like when it happens. But the reality is that when it does happen, it is the most natural thing that you can imagine. And it is a total non-issue. For anyone who's...
How can that be? It doesn't seem natural to not see daylight.
Well, in 56 particularly, and also in 60, we sledged right throughout winter on the sea ice. You just become a nocturnal creature. And that's natural enough to a nocturnal creature. Human beings can adapt to that pretty readily. It isn't an issue. Similarly, the fear of isolation and the thought of the tight community and not being able to get away, well, all these things are fears that are imagined rather than real fears.
All right, let me put a real fear in front of you. I've seen one of your pictures there, and it's an image of a big caterpillar. I think that's what it's called, isn't it?
A gigantic D5, yes.
D5, a huge bit of snow traversing equipment, a gigantic caterpillar machine, tractor. And it's fallen pretty much entirely into a crevasse.
Yeah.
Now,
no, it's fallen thoroughly.
The NRMA is a long way away. But there's not a tow truck in sight.
Yeah.
Is the temptation just to go and walk away?
Oh, we'd love to be able to. We never had those
never
sort
happened.
Of resources. I had an American friend who one time said, didn't you? Goddamn Aussie, you're so goddamn stupid, you don't know what you can't do. Well, that was a bit of an advantage because we had no option but to do it. Yes, that tractor fell nose down and it actually lodged 5 metres below the snow surface, hanging nose down over a effectively bottomless hole. Once they get deep enough, they might as well be bottomless. In fact, it might even be better if they're bottomless because you don't have that sudden stop at the end of them.
Was anyone in it at the time?
Yes.
Were you in it at the time?
No, I wasn't. No, I was running with the dogs and I didn't... it wasn't in that. No, the chap that was in it was a man of firm decision, but not necessarily impeccable judgment. And he'd unhooked his tractor trying to go to help another tractor that was less badly in a crevasse. And he tore off and he dived nose first into this hole. Shook everyone up fairly seriously, especially as he had a... His lack of judgment manifests in the fact that he always refused to wear his seat belt. So the tractor hung up on a lump hanging out of the side of the crevasse and its nose hit it and it kicked the back of the tractor across, which hit the opposite side of the crevasse. So this thing was precariously perched at an angle.
So how did you get it out?
With a good deal of difficulty. We had only hand equipment, of course, chain blocks.
What, by human power?
Human power, yes.
You dragged it out?
Yeah. No, we didn't drag it out. We secured it first thing with dead men in the ice so that it wasn't going any further. We then, at the rear of the tractor, cut with shovels and axes a ramp down to the back of the tractor, leaving a pillar supporting the rear of the tractor and then a ramp back up onto the surface.
And you got it out. Look, I've only left a moment and a couple of minutes left to talk to you. I feel like I could talk to you for another 2 hours, Sid Kirkby. You're such a fascinating man. Finally, after several decades' work, an issue that really motivates you at the moment is the fact that many of the place names in Antarctica seem to be being changed. These are place names that have been of mountains, of geographical features that have been named by you and other explorers through your hard work and courage and all those things, and they're being changed. Why?
I have no idea, and I don't even know who did it or when it was done, but I accidentally came across the knowledge that names would have been applied by explorers, and the names explorers apply have relevance to the exploration process. And anyone looking at a map is entitled to expect that they reflect the history, the names on the map reflect the history of exploration. And so these were names which we applied, names of my comrades, and I noticed suddenly that those names don't appear on the maps anymore.
These are names that honour the people who went.
Absolutely, yeah.
And took those risks. Yeah. Risked their lives to go and went out there.
That's exactly right. And I think it's a very shabby treatment. No doubt the cry will go, the name still exists, it's just that you don't see it anymore on the map. Well, not a lot of point in having a name that isn't on a map. And these, my comrades, deserve honouring. We did not name these features lightly or in a whim. They deserve to have their names on the map.
Sid Kirkby, I have so much enjoyed this conversation. I just absolutely adored it. It's been wonderful to meet you. Thank you so much for being with me today in conversation.
Pleasure, Rich.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.